So when we come into formal meditation, there's this foundational gesture that we make of turning toward something like solitude or what the texts call seclusion, viveka. And seclusion in the way the word is used in the descriptions of meditation, it means a couple of things. It means seclusion from the hindrances, the hindrances of sensual desire, hatred, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor, and skeptical doubt. But it also means seclusion from the play of the senses generally. And so we can think of that as setting the intention to not be pulled away from what I'm intending to do in meditation by something appearing as a sight or a sound or a thought or a taste or a smell or a sensation. So I turn toward meditation and I have to intentionally set aside the tendency that I have to be pulled away into something. And so that could mean, you know, if I'm in I'm in my room and maybe there's some unfinished business or something that wants to be cleaned up or done, or there's an object that reminds me of somebody or something that's happening, that I intentionally pull my gaze, my attention away from that. It's conscious. It's intentional. You know, when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to really watch like scary movies, for which I actually am grateful to my parents for making that boundary. But once I was a teenager, you know, everyone smiled at somebody else's house, I would find myself in the room where there was like some really horrible imagery on the television. I grew up in the era of, you know, kind of slasher movies and these kind of really violent media experiences. And then in the, you know, late 70s into the 80s and early 90s. And very, very early on, I realized that I didn't like seeing it. First of all, I didn't like the nervous system fear in those kinds of films. But what I really didn't like was actually seeing the violent image. And so I would close my eyes kind of secretly so as to not be uncool. But I would kind of secretly kind of just like not look. And, you know, and I would hear the sounds of the movie and it wasn't pleasant, but it was better to not look. And I could really feel that I was protecting myself in a way from the assault of that image. And it still feels that way, you know. As I moved into my teenage years, I actually realized that I was also uncomfortable watching sitcoms because a lot of sitcoms in the 80s, maybe they still do, but I don't watch them anymore. But the plot point turned on humiliation or a moment of embarrassment or somebody, you know, doing something kind of embarrassing or shameful. And I noticed that I couldn't stand looking at that either. So I would close my eyes, or I would pretend I had to pee, and I would leave the room. There's a way that contemporary life and media life puts in front of our eyes and ears startling nervous system material daily, just constantly, really, so often, and unlike maybe sometimes in the past where you could choose not to read a certain book or watch a certain movie or whatever, startling content is filtered in between other things. It's all mixed up together. So like you might say, I'm going to choose not to watch, violent footage of the war. But your social media feed, whatever your platform of choice is, it might have a completely like unprocessable mix of, pictures of somebody's cat, new age memes about how God is everywhere, advertisements for the children's play downtown, and then violent pictures of the war, all just stacked absurdly on top of each other. It's actually difficult to bring the attention to a kind of seclusion in it, for many of us in the lives that we lead. And so there's an encouragement, though, that I think that the texts, the teachings of the Buddha that orient toward deep meditation suggest that I think is really helpful for us as we try to figure out how to live well right now, which is that sensory stimulation is destabilizing by its very nature, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. The first two hindrances are, sensual desire and hatred and ill will. It's not just hatred and ill will that's destabilizing. And by destabilizing, I mean just stirring up in the consciousness. Sensual desire, which is a way of saying encountering pleasure and liking it and wanting more of it, pleasurable sensate things, pleasurable things to look at or hear or think about or feel with the body. Pleasurable sensual experiences, habitually bring about wanting more pleasurable sensual experiences. And that's, and again, this isn't a moral condemnation of them. It's actually just a recognition that we are the kind of animals that when we encounter pleasurable sensual contact, we want more of it. And so that wanting more stirs up the body mind, right? It mobilizes the musculature to turn toward that which we want. It mobilizes the intention and volitional channels to set plans in motion to get more of what we want. My early 20s, I spent some time hitchhiking back and forth across the country, and it took a long time to get rides. This was in the early 1990s, and it wasn't like the glory days of hitchhiking in North America. And sometimes I would wait for 6 hours, 8 hours for a ride. I slept in train stations and in people's garages in the Midwest and any old odd place really for a while. And I had some adventures and momentary danger, mostly not too dangerous, fortunately, given my presentation and social location. It could have been worse, could have been more dangerous. But at one point, I was hitchhiking back from the East Coast. I had been across Canada to New York. I was heading back. And on my way out, I had momentarily crossed paths with a young woman in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I was in like upstate New York checking around, and I had no plans. And so I just thought, well, she was nice. And what that really meant was we had actually traded like three sentences only on a street corner at one point where I was like, you're nice. And she was basically like, hi. That's kind of about it. But I had her phone number. And I was like, well, maybe I'll go back and see if anything's possible with that, with that girl. Sensual desire. I was 2,000 plus miles away and I had to hitchhike with no money, waiting for rides. It was going to take me weeks to get there. And I was like, why don't I do that? Because there's somebody that might be sweet to me, like on the other side of the continent. So I headed there. Talk about a sort of North Star, right? That was sensual desire was my North Star at the time. So the proposed topic tonight is the jhana factors, and we're talking about Anapanasati. Anapanasati is really a set of meditation instructions that orient toward deep stillness and gatheredness and seclusion, really, of the body and mind, settling the mind and the body and the bodily energies toward states of extraordinary smoothness, settledness, and in that smoothness and settledness, a kind of upwelling, pleasurable, blissful, nourishing energy called piti or rapture, and the subtler energy, the emotional joy of stillness called sukha, ease, deep ease, peace of mind. And these are the subjects of steps 5 and 6 in the Anapanasati sequence. So we've been practicing with this sequence for some time. It begins with coming into mindfulness of the breath as it comes and goes. And then step 1, knowing the long breath. Step 2, knowing the short breath. And with that foundation, then orienting towards stillness. And in step 3, training to breathe, knowing the whole body. And in step 4, training in calming the body and stilling the body. So the whole first set goes from connecting with the wave of energetic movement in the body that comes with the breath, and then gradually letting that movement go from large to small, to spread out through the whole body, and then to stillness. And everything is getting quieter and stiller. In the second set of instructions, the second group of 4, or tetrad, we pick it up there with the sense of the breath in the whole body and stillness. And then step 5 invites, which means both tuning into what's there, but also invoking and strengthening the somatic pleasurable energy called rapture, or piti in Pali. This is a kind of sensual pleasure. It shows up as a sort of hum or buzz or tingle or energetic wave in the body. But it has this very special quality, as does the emotional quality of ease or happiness or sukha that follows it, which is that it's not based on external sensory contact. So I'm not having a sensual pleasure because I'm in contact with something else, right? I'm seeing someone I like, I'm hearing a sound I like. I don't even have to be physically completely comfortable. You can find piti and the body full with this kind of ease when, you know, you have an aching hip or a sore knee or a sore back. It's not exactly a physical sensation in the same way. It is a sensation, but it's not caused by contact with something outside yourself. It's caused by the attention, the mind, becoming quite still, and in that stillness and the connecting with the whole body, the steadied mind connecting with the body gives rise to a felt sense of the body as a different kind of thing. And some people will use words like energetic body, subtle body. I think really it's just that when my attention is not turning outward, when I have a little bit of that seclusion, attention rests inward, the sense of the body. And then the energetic sense of, you know, all so much energy is moving in the body all the time, cellular movement and breath and pulsing of different kinds, you start to feel that. And it comes through as a kind of somatic presence that can really fill out and can get quite bright. And so the piti and sukha, rapture and bliss, or rapture and happiness, are pleasures that are not externally oriented sensual pleasures as much as they are the pleasures of steadiness, seclusion, immersion. And from the cultivating of those two, PT is more the physical somatic brightness, and Sukha has more of a subtle, profound contentment and ease to it. Like if you get that still, and then the body starts to light up with pleasure, there can be come through the physical pleasure of jhana or the vibratoriness of sorry of piti, and landing in sukha, even invoking sukha a little bit, is like invoking, like, oh, what if I just like in a really radical sort of way, stop complaining, even subtly, even fidgeting subtly. The body is becoming still, the energy is becoming still, and it's just like there's nothing to do right now. And sukha can be like the deep pleasure of that. And then steps 7 and 8, the rest of the second tetrad, invite us to connect with the, mostly I call it like the mind stuff. The Pali word is citta sankhara, and that's a little complicated. Citta is like the heart mind, the conscious heart mind, and the knowing part of the heart mind, and sankhara is the volitional formations or karmic formations. Those are like translations from the Pali. They are, it's like the combination of choice and story. So the stories about who we are, what we're doing, and the various choices we make around those stories, all of that stuff is the sankhara. And really it's all the stuff we cling to, basically, all the stories and the dramas and the content. It's the content of the mind. So you're invited to connect with the content of the mind here, and then to bring in step 8 that content to stillness. So in a simple way, we could say this is like connect with the thinking channel and still the thinking, bring the thinking to stillness. Mostly how I practice with this is like if I'm really some fairly focused in the steps that are about, you know, the rapture and the ease, and the body's pretty still, the thinking actually has significantly subsided already here. And so connecting with thinking, as we did today in the meditation, it can often be just like connecting with the thought space or the mind space. You can just connect with the sense of the thinking part of the process. And then, you know, it's like letting even the impulse to entertain a narrative or a thought stream, letting that impulse die down. Remember that sankhara partly means volition or choice, volitional content. So there's a little burst of volition every time you think about something. You don't notice it because it's very quick and very subtle, but it's in there. At this level of concentration, when the mind is well nourished and pretty peaceful, you can see that, and you can see like the impulse to move towards story, and you can just not act on it. And then the story settles into stillness again. So Piti and Sukha are the third and fourth elements in a different list called the jhana factors. This is a list that shows up in the commentaries, in the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification commentary, from Buddhaghosa in the 5th century. And it's a really useful list. I'll say it in brief, and we'll talk about it more in subsequent talks. We've talked about parts of it quite a lot in other talks. The first two steps are connecting and sustaining, is the translation I like. The Pali words are vitakka and vichara. Vitakka is like aiming or connecting or contactful attention. So you can think of that as the moment your attention is directed towards something and makes contact with it, like knows what you're seeing. So, you know, if you turn to look over your shoulder at something in your space intentionally, like I know that the cello is over there, I turn to look at it. I'm intentionally turning my attention toward it and my gaze, And when I do that, there's a contacting it, right? I see it and I'm with it, with the attention. I recognize it, basically. Mostly we do this all the time unconsciously. But now, if I wanted to be to work on being undistracted, I could connect with a thing and then with a little more effort, keep my attention there, even though other things are pulling on it, right? Things are pulling on your attention all the time. This gets back to the media and overstimulation piece. The first step, connecting with something, is usually pretty easy. You think about what you want to connect with. There it is, right? You notice it almost automatically. But then the second step, sustaining, is actually, but can you keep your attention with that thing, even though in the next second, something else is going to pull on it? So, you know, you could practice that. Like, let's say you're scrolling on your social media feed at some point, and you come upon some friend of yours who's written a long thing, right? Or somebody has pasted an entire, you know, article from The Atlantic into your feed, and you click read more, and suddenly, like, there's 3 pages worth of text. You could easily just click away or scroll away to something, and perhaps you should, right? But if you do the action of saying, like, oh, I actually want to read this, you have to change what your mind is doing. You can't just keep scrolling and looking for the next thing. You have to kind of stop, connect with it, slow down, and then stay with it. So you actually read the article, you know, you read the long form of the thing. And while you're reading a long form article, whether on social media or in any format, or reading a novel for that matter, or having a sustained conversation with a friend while your phone is vibrating in your pocket, you have to resist the urge to turn your attention to other things, right? In the middle of doing something, your attention is going to be pulled on. And so vichara is the sustaining thought or the sustained attention that actually keeps your attention with something, even though there's forces trying to pull it away, right? So vitaka is, you know, vitaka is clicking on something. Vichara is the firewall that keeps everything else away. Those two are your foundational meditative skills, right? And really the encouragement is to nurture those all the time. You know, when you're having a conversation with a friend at a cafe, if you can, right, put your phone away, put your phones away, like, ignore the other people, look at your friend, listen to your friend, like, connect and sustain your attention. See if you can make eye contact and sustain eye contact, even though something's pulling on your attention to go elsewhere. You know, when you're reading something or watching something or eating something, you can practice connecting with the thing and sustaining your attention there, resisting the pull to jump away. So vitaka and vichara are the first two jhana factors, meaning factors that support absorption, meditative absorption, samadhi. The third and fourth are our good friends from this anapanasati practice, rapture and ease, or piti and sukha. So the sequence goes: connect, sustain, rapture will arise, and sukha is the stabilization of that into deep ease. That's a sequence that you can cultivate in a lot of things. But rapture particularly is a byproduct of meditative concentration. And for me, at least, and a lot of folks, it doesn't show up throughout ordinary life, with maybe one exception, which is that, and this is different for everyone, but for me, PT will sometimes show up when I'm in the presence of an emotionally moving thing. It shows up not as the emotional movement, but as a kind of thrill when, particularly like at the denouement of a story, it'll show up. So if I have a strong emotion in relation to something real, like grief, like I'm talking with someone about a tragedy or something that's happening, it won't be PT that comes. It'll be something else. It'll be the upwelling of tears or some other kind of strong feeling. But I'll get an upwelling of PT at the peak moment in an adventure movie. I guess we're talking about movies tonight, you know, like I'll get it at the peak moment of a Dr. Seuss book, for that matter, at the heroic moment when the story turns toward goodness, I'll get a wave of like my whole body will light up with a sort of energy. But mostly in daily life, it's PT, the meditative PT doesn't show up because we're not secluded. We're not actually in such a sheltered space. Our attention is engaging with sensual pleasures all the time and stimulation. But these four are a beautiful sequence for nurturing in meditation itself, right? Always vitakka and vichara as the foundation. And then as we bring attention to the whole body, you can start to get the sense of piti moving. And if you can really land with sukha and cultivate that sense, that's one that you can just stay with for a long time. Like that's get good at giving rise to sukha and staying with it, and you're very well set up both for a nourishing, pleasurable meditation. What the Buddha called a pleasurable abiding in a blissful abiding in the here and now, that's sukha. I like that it kind of sounds like sugar, sukha, sukr. But it's happiness or ease. And the fifth of the jhana factors, we'll talk about this more later, is one-pointedness, ekagata. And so that's really like based on the attentional focus of the first two and the somatic consolidation of piti and sukha, ekagata is really the recognition that attention has profoundly stabilized. And there's only one thing filling awareness. So the initial steps then of Anapanasati, I think they imply vitakka and vichara as we are turning attention to the breath, connecting with the breath in its various lengths, and then stilling the body, bringing the attention to the whole body. And then piti and sukha are named directly. And as we go on, engaging with the mind stuff, stilling the mind, we start to develop this ekagata, this one-pointedness. The five jhana factors are said to be the marker that what's called access or neighborhood concentration is being developed. That's the stage before you enter formal meditative absorption. All right, that's the technical bit. I've said what I was going to say tonight as far as the technicalities of concentration and how these qualities show up in the Anapanasati sequence. And it's unavoidable to it's not possible for me to avoid saying that we are many of us a witness to the outbreak of a horrible war. And one that has been simmering for our entire lifetimes. And that's true, I think, no matter how old you are, unless you're over 75, and you predate the modern beginning of the tension in the Middle East. But for most of our lifetimes, this the long very difficult struggle for peace in the land of Palestine that's now called Israel and Palestine in various forms has been, erupting and quieting and erupting and quieting. And I just want to acknowledge that this new war beginning with the brutal attack of Hamas on communities in southern Israel, and then the brutal response that Israel has begun giving back to Gaza is underway. And it's impossible not to know that this is happening, at least for me and for many folks in my larger community. So I just want to acknowledge that and say that it's unavoidable in consciousness, and to And to remind us that, just to remember together the teachings that conflict and violence arise in the world because the root causes of dissatisfaction have not been uprooted, that there is hatred and fear of others, that there is a grasping for resources, which really means a grasping for security, safety, pleasure, identity, existence, life, safety. That the desire for life and safety and well-being is intrinsic to our kind of animal. And that the Buddha would say that until they are eradicated from the heart, greed, hatred, and delusion will continue to guide our actions. This is the whole purpose of the Dharma, is to find a deeper healing than any external regulation can find. You can police a people's into not committing acts of violence to some degree, but you can't police people into their hearts being healed. You can protect folks with borders and militaries, and at various times it is completely appropriate to do so, I think, but protecting people will never by itself heal their hearts or the hearts of their enemies from hatred. And that only through the complete eradication of the tendency toward hatred from the heart can war be uprooted from our own actions. And it's core in the Dharma that the conditions for war and violence, conflict, you can't eradicate them for anyone else. That actually there's the true healing of the heart can only be done by practicing, and you can only practice for yourself. And that doesn't mean that you can't practice in community, and you must. You also can't figure it out without community, but you can't actually do the action of concentrating the mind, directing the attention, turning the heart toward inquiry, and letting go of the impulse toward violence. You can't do that for someone else. The Buddha was asked, with all your great power, can you heal beings of their suffering and their fear and their hatred? And he said, I cannot do it. Each person, each being must do this for themselves. It must be this way, because liberation isn't somehow changing our state permanently so that, we never again have a certain feeling. That's too fragile. That would be like saying, I don't know, right? If we could permanently, if we could permanently have everyone just have a little more, like serotonin and oxytocin in their systems, then maybe they would be kinder. We should just put it in the water, That's not liberation. Even if it worked to keep an entire population docile and loving and honest and, beautifully open-hearted, if it's external, it's not actually uprooting the causes of hatred. And we can only uproot those causes in ourselves. And so we walk a path together, and we support others in the world trying to find their path. But we're invited by the Dharma to recognize that that the karma of all beings is their own. This is the signature phrase associated with the practice of equanimity, is all beings are the owners of their karma. And here that means the owners of their own actions, heirs to their actions, born of their actions, related to their actions, abide supported by their actions. Whatever action they do, for good or for ill, of that they will be the heir. This is a difficult wisdom. It suggests to us that we can't save anyone. And of course, you know, you can save people physically, right? You can intervene in a conflict and save some people physically. May as many people possible that can be saved in this conflict be saved, for sure. Absolutely. On all sides. There's no sides. There's people, right? There are aggressors and there are attackers and defenders all over, and there's true conflict, but it's all people. It's all people. And so the difficult wisdom of the equanimity teaching is that, you know, we can help, we can serve, we can love, we can care for, we can try to be wise and discerning what to do under very complicated circumstances, but everyone's actions are their own. And so the choices that each person makes and each community makes and each organization makes and each government makes, which is composed of people, so it really comes down to individuals in a certain way. The choice every individual makes is their own. And the choice that groups of people make working together is theirs. And those people, those groups who make choices, they will bear the consequences of those. Everyone will bear the consequences of their own actions, and that there's no way around that. I think one of the most helpful ways to be present with the outbreak of a war that's an expression of an ancient trauma like this is to try to be supported by these teachings on equanimity, and of course the teachings on compassion, the practices of compassion for everyone, the practices of non-judgment, if we can manage it, knowing that the conditions are very complex that are leading to everyone's actions, that there's trauma on all sides. But more than that, it helps me to to widen the lens of my understanding of what's happening, that I can so easily get caught in, you know, because I know the history of the last 20 years, you know, oh, I think these people are doing right or these people are doing wrong. Or because I know the history of the last 75 years, oh, I know the history of the founding of Israel and the displacement of the Palestinians, the history of Palestinian terrorism and Israeli, you know, and I know the history of anti-Semitism going back how many thousands of years? Like, that's helpful. All of that's helpful. And to go further and to somehow hold, like, oh, you know, I actually know, you know, to know just enough history. You don't have to go and become a history expert, although it's not a bad idea, but know something about, like this whole part of the world, and just go back to, you know, back through the centuries of the wars and the peace and the communities and, you know, the various empires. Go back past Israel, go, you know, back into the Ottoman Empire, go back past the Ottoman Empire, go back to the Persian Empire, go to, you know, communities of indigenous sheep herders going up and down the mountains of the Caucasus and down into the Fertile Crescent and into, go back to the ancient human cultures and maybe even before that, and just to feel the forces moving throughout a piece of land. I think sometimes the human story can be so overwhelming, the narrative's so compelling. Israel's actions are a result of the Holocaust. Hamas's actions are a result of the catastrophe, the Nakba. Go further, and to say like, oh, here's a piece of land that has been for all of human history, for some groups of people, like the center of the world. And so much swirling around this particular center of the world, a kind of power center at the edge of a great sea, at the confluence of continents, and just feeling the stirred upness of this place and the people that have stitched their identity to this place. So maybe I'll kind of pause there. It's helpful for me to be able to pull the lens way back and to zoom the lens in. And I think the purpose of doing so is to not get lost in any one thread of the narrative, but to be able to see that there's always more complexity and more layers there than we know. How does this relate to, meditative concentration and connecting with bliss through the body? The world has always been riven by war and catastrophe, human rot, as long as humans have been doing their thing. And before that, if there were stories about, how unjust the Tyrannosaurus were and how they didn't really respect the rights of all the peace-loving vegetarian dinosaurs. Like, the world of conscious existence is wrought by conflict. And so the Buddha knows this, right? He's seen countless past lives characterized by suffering. And he, in his very own time, his kingdom, the neighboring kingdom, kingdoms are going to war right and left. And right in the middle of it, and he's counseling kings, he's advocating for peace, but he's also teaching people to slow down, to bring their attention away from the external, and to settle into a natural somatic ease that's available at any moment, and that this is the way to being truly free. Not that you rest in that state all the time, but that state teaches you something about what's real and how you might spend your time. You recover from the addiction to external stories and stimulation. And you recover from obsessively thinking about the war, because there's all as was named in our check-in, there's always a war somewhere for someone. And it doesn't matter if it's a tiny, insignificant war or a major earth-shaking war. For somebody, that means their family is being harmed, people being killed, and lives being disrupted and lost. And so I think we have to do both, right? You don't hide from the world. You can't anyway, or it's very difficult to do so now. But actually, there's no need. But there is a need to nourish the heart with seclusion sometimes. And so we practice this ancient turning away for a moment from the war and uplifting The bodies. Wisdom that knows the rightness of ease and the birthright of ease. And if we refuse to accept the pleasure that is here, that harms no one, I think it's a profound loss in this human life to reject that possibility of that. It's one of the great beauties that we have as our inheritance, and especially as beings blessed by the stream of the Dharma. So, may our practice cultivate inward joy, outward compassion and outward joy. May we understand the weave between compassion and joy that enables the heart to stay open and breathe through everything. Right. Thanks for your warm, kind attention. I'm trying to speak to some of that.